Wisdom of the Wicked podcast. Yaz is still away. Rumour has it he's geocaching, but as ever, don't take my word for it. So it's me, Ben Gardner, filling in again. And we've got the WCM pair of magazine editor Joe Harmon and editor-in-chief Phil Walker, as well as staff writer James Jim Wallace, joining us to discuss the IPL, some big English cricket news, and to pick out a season in the Sun 11. But first of all, since Yaz isn't here, I've decided to bring back an old favourite. Phil?
Yes?
What's your moment of the week?
Learning about geocaching. we'll leave Yaz alone. So we're bringing it back just for the 1 week, the moment of the week.
Well, you know, quite cheeky. If people like
it. If we do it really well, then Yaz might let us keep it.
Yeah, got to run it by the big man, though, haven't we? All right, well, we cross that bridge when we come to it. My moment of the week has to be Joss Butler's mini masterpiece to keep Rajasthan Royals in this year's IPL. He was moved down the order, having opened for the majority of the tournament. Batted at five against Chennai on a bit of a dog of a pitch. Chennai huffed and puffed to get to 125. It was one of these kind of hinge games as well for both teams. Neither of them have particularly lit the tournament up. And Butler's own story is probably reflective of that as well. He's simmered away, but he hasn't really quite nailed it too much yet in this tournament. They moved him down to number five, chasing 125. They were three for spit, and Butler then batted as if on another level, really, to everyone else in that game. And it was a pedigree game. You had Stokes opening for Rajasthan. You had Duplessis opening for Chennai. You had quality throughout both orders. And yet Butler just played a different level of cricket, really. 70 not out, and he took them home quite comfortably in the end to keep them in the tournament. They are hanging in there just about. They probably need to, well, they certainly need to win their last four to be sure of a place in the last four. They can maybe get away with three out of four, but it's the business end of this tournament now. And Rajasthan, who's my team, for obvious pathetic parochial reasons, because Jofra opens the bowling and Stokes and Butler are in the side, they are hanging in there. And if they win this afternoon, admittedly this show might go out after this, so this might already be dead in the water, but if they win this afternoon, then they're still in it. And it's bubbling away. It's been quite a gripping tournament, actually.
Yeah. Are there implications in Butler's innings for England, do you think? Obviously, that's the debate in their T20i team.
Possibly, but then when he opened against Australia at the end of this summer, he just cruised 77 not out, one of the most complete innings in that format you could possibly wish to see, because he was facing some serious high-end world-class pace. And he saw them off sensibly. He was 20-odd off 20 balls, wasn't he, in that game? And then when the lesser bowlers came on, it was masterful from up top. The thing is, he can do it either way. I can understand why Rajasthan have put him in the middle order, because they were spluttering through games, and they don't really have that designated finisher in their side. They're a bit of a lopsided cricket team, Rajasthan, so I can understand why they moved him down. But I think in England's case, because they have those players naturally in the middle anyway, you know, Morgan is a finisher, Stokes is a finisher in T20 cricket, I think it makes sense for him to open for England in the T20 side. But he's just. I think it was, it might have been Vaughan, it might not have been, I can't remember. Somebody said he's got to be pound for pound the best white ball batsman in the world. Now, you know, AB de Villiers might have something to say about that, and one or two others might have something to say about that. But he's not far off it. He's the complete white ball player, I would say. And my love is forever May when it comes to him. You know, it's a love supreme for Joss Butler.
Yeah. The subplot for me as well.
Thanks, mate.
The subplot for me in that innings was Steve Smith ticking along at strike rate of about 70, sort of a 90s era one-day strike rate. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just as a side point, Smith is really, really struggling. I thought about Joe Root the other day, who's desperate to play T20 IPL cricket. Mm. And you must be watching that and seeing Smith scrabble around and thinking, well, hold on. You know, why have I never got a gig in this thing? I think he will, Root, by the end of his run. I think he will prioritise that in the end.
Well, this competition in particular would have really suited him, because run rates haven't been huge. Yeah.
Totally, absolutely.
He's the problem he'll have is that he did very well in the Blast, didn't he, this summer when he got his chances, but didn't have a very good big bash out there.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of, that's a black mark on his record when franchises are looking around and wondering, who do we go for? And you do get pigeonholed a little bit. Mm. But he's with a proper bit of T20 cricket behind him. I've no doubt he's good enough.
Yeah. That's a good start on the moment of the week front. Jim, can you carry the momentum on? What's yours?
Mine is...
no pressure.
Yeah.
Yes, it's
Jim or
down.
James. Mine is IPL 2. It's the three super overs in one day, which never been seen before.
The day the IPL jumped the shark.
Absolutely, yeah.
The day Spurs gave away a 3-0 lead 5 minutes ago.
Enough of that.
Yeah, that didn't register with me this week. But Kolkata, so it was quite good because you had Owen Morgan pitted against Trevor Bayliss on opposite sides with Kolkata Knight Riders versus Sunrisers, and Lockie Ferguson doing a demolition job and getting two wickets in three balls. Yeah, so that was you don't often see that. And then the next match was just ridiculous. So they had one super over, both teams scored five, and then they came out for another one, and no one really knew what was going on. You had to. You had Anil Kumble sort of checking the rules. You have to use a whole new set of players, apparently. So not even the substitute batsman was allowed to come out, if that's right. So the eight players that are selected. So then I thought, and also I read that they just keep having super overs. So it got a bit Kafka-esque. I really wanted another one. And another one, and just to see how many players they could get through them. You know, like when a keeper scores a penalty, like takes a penalty in a penalty shootout. Yeah. You know, maybe Bayliss and Kumble would have had to come out, or whoever will. Like, not Bayliss.
Fancy Kumble in that.
Yeah, I reckon, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, how many... Because it ticked over into the next day, because they play quite late, don't they?
Yeah.
So it went into the Monday. Mm.
Did it?
Yeah.
Went past the witching hour.
Went past into the next day.
Right.
So I just thought, I really wanted another super, at least, you know, three in one match would be quite good.
Yeah. My favourite subplot from that game was Chris Jordan, who obviously we talked about extensively last week and has...
You put the boot in, didn't you?
Well, we did. No, you did.
You put the boot in.
But since then, he's bounced back. Obviously, we've used the stick method rather than the carrot, and that's worked.
He's been listening.
He took a wicket and went and sit at six and a bit and over in his first game after that podcast was recorded. But then it was in that super over game, there's form for Jordan in this tournament, because the first super over game in this tournament, they needed one off three balls, which became one off one, and then he holed out. And then in this game, they needed two off the last, and Jordan sort of turned like an ocean liner coming back for the second. And he went so far around, sort of going around the square leg umpire to get into his crease. And even Brian Lara was making fun of him on Twitter, did a little video. And when you've managed to amuse Brian Lara, I think you've gone...
Lara lampooned him with a silly video.
Yeah, he did. Blimey. Yeah.
Sounds like a cry for help by the big man.
Yeah, and then
Joe, you're conspicuously quiet on the IPL, mate.
Well, I am. I don't want to bore people with the details, but to say I'm between TV service providers at the moment, and never get Sky is the other thing I'll add. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah,
you can. That'll probably wipe out 30 grand off the advertising budget. Oh, but God. Cheers.
But anyway, I won't go into details because I'll just get angry, and it's just...
Have you got a TV, but it's not working?
Yeah, so I can obviously watch it on my laptop, but I'm actually also need to do some work on my laptop, and it's difficult. And I'm very conscientious.
Absolutely.
As you'll
is that old line in Seinfeld? What's all your furniture pointed at if you don't have a TV? But you've got a TV.
Well, it's still pointed
work.
At the TV.
That's, oh, right,
just
that's
makes
good.
It all the more depressing. Do you want my moment then?
Well, if I could,
no.
If I could just first finish on Jordan, because
this whole moment thing's collapsing around us.
We've since got the scoop on Jordan's. He called it his baffling route for the second run. Tahir Hashim spoke to him yesterday morning. He said, Jordan said, "I know, watching from the outside, that route I took to come back for the second looked baffling, but I actually lost my footing on the turn at the non-striker's end. If I tried to go back in the same direction, I definitely would have slipped up and fallen down. I changed my line back to get to the other end, which almost made it. The ball hit my foot on the way too, so I thought it deflected, which is why I didn't dive, and it was just short. When that happens, you're thinking, not again." so that's the inside scoop on why.
That's an exclusive there.
It is.
I've never heard it described as a route back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can all rest easy now.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Put that one to bed.
But really good to see him back in form, and it is comforting to know that he can do it in those sort of press situations. And he then bowled the winning super over in that game as well.
He did. It's almost like he's a pretty good pedigree T20 cricketer. Yeah.
Exactly. So we'll hold off on your moment for the moment, Joe, because it's non-IPL related. And if we can get through the IPL...
God, I really do feel sidelined. I'm going to get my TV sorted next week, I promise.
In time for the final.
So my moment is AB de Villiers winning Bangalore again from nowhere. They needed 35 of the last two overs, at which point he flicks the switch, hits 3-6 and three balls off the hapless Jadhav Unadkat. And then a few balls later, hits another six to bring up his 50 and hit the winning runs all in one go.
Off Archer, I think Archer had the last over.
I think that's right, yeah. It just feels to me as if and I mean, as you say, people are going to disagree, but he's still actually by a distance for me the best T20 batsman at least in the world. And if he was playing one day in Test cricket, he'd probably be near the top of that as well. I mean, Butler is the other person in terms of being able to do all the roles you'd ask of someone. He's the other, but AB can do like everything to such a high level. He can build that innings. He can come out and smash from ball one. He can sort of buy his time a little bit and then pick his ball and explode. And you kind of wonder each time that, because he doesn't play that much cricket these days, that each time a tournament rolls around, that it's like, is this time he's going to have lost it? And if anything, he seems to almost be getting better, kind of more refined, more kind of honed as a player. And just in the wider thing of South Africa, if he does end up playing that T20 World Cup, Quinton de Kock has really hit his straps in the last kind of week or so in the IPL. Amrik Nautia, we discussed last week. Rabada is obviously a brilliant bowler. Chris Morris has been only come in halfway through the tournament and has kind of turned Bangalore into like a like real title contenders. So that's obviously South Africa always going to a global tournament being quite hyped, and it never quite works out for them, but it does seem like they're going to be a real force to be reckoned with at that next T20 World Cup.
Yeah, I know there were rumours around his potential return for that now, you know, pushed back tournament, but is that on the cards properly, that he'll be back?
I think so. It seemed almost set in stone if it was going to be in October that he'd be back. And I think the fact that you have all these sort of...
With Smith and Boucher there.
Exactly.
I think there's a lot more persuasion there to get De Villiers back on board. It feels like an inevitability. And also, the fact that you just pick up, having not played for so long, just join these tournaments and play so naturally is still so impressive. But I guess the flip side of that is he comes in fresh every time. He's not got the calendar that everyone else has. And that was his main reason for leaving the international scene in the first place.
Yeah, it was getting burnt out, wasn't he, really?
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I just on that specific example of yours, I was watching that as well. And it was weird, wasn't it? Because it felt, if not inevitable, then likely that he was going to win the game. And yet, if you look at it on paper, they needed 31 off two overs. And yet you're thinking, nah, that if he's on strike, then yeah, they'll probably pull this off. And Smith should have bowled Archer for that penultimate over. That seems to be the convention now, that your absolute gun bowler bowls the penultimate. They bowled the left armer. He took him downtown, and that was pretty much that. And there was an air of inevitability about it. Kohli on De Villiers is good because he's just in awe of him, isn't he? You imagine being a cricketer where Kohli's in awe of you. That must be quite a giggle.
Well, it's interesting though, isn't it? It's almost like the two paths to greatness in a way. Like Kohli is a player who he's like kind of made the absolute maximum of everything he does. He sort of like runs twos better than anyone else. He's so fit, like obviously in the gym, like constantly kind of thing. Whereas an ABW is not that he doesn't do all those things very well as well, but there's just that extra little like sprinkle of stardust, I guess, that he can just like do the absolute freakish things that basically no other cricketer in the world can do.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I like to think that Kohli's kind of a bit crap at tennis and not very good at snooker and that sort of things, whereas obviously De Villiers is a world champion at everything.
Famously bad at darts, I think, Virat.
Is he?
Yeah, he just...
There
yeah,
you go.
Can't hit the board.
Bar billiards.
His bowling
rubbish.
Was always a bit embarrassing. He doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess he's a bit above that. But yeah, that was pretty rank.
Sort of off-footed, yeah. He did a... we actually... Odd that you mentioned it, because we had a piece on the part-timers who got really big wickets on wisden.com this week, and he had Kevin Peterson stumped off technically his zeroth delivery in T20i cricket, because it was a wide, and then Tony stumped
zeroth.
So you had Kohli bowling, Peterson stumped Tony, bowled Kohli off an illegal delivery.
Which marvellous.
Quite something, yeah. So,
it's good stuff.
Joe, what
yes!
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week is the news that came through yesterday that England are going to South Africa for a white ball tour from November 27th. Three T20s, three ODIs split across Cape Town and Paarl behind closed doors, obviously. Look, it's obviously fantastic news for us as journalists, because we have some cricket to cover over the next few weeks and months. That's a relief. It's obviously fantastic for fans, but it is particularly fantastic for Cricket South Africa, who are in dire straits financially. Neil Manthorpe, who is the best informed writer on South African cricket around, described this tour as critical to the financial survival of Cricket South Africa. He says that if the tour hadn't gone ahead, they stood to lose 70 million rand, which amounts to more than 3 million quid, money they just can't afford to lose at all. So there was a lot riding on this tour. So kind of however it goes, it's already been a success for cricket in South Africa in some senses. But Neil does say that there is real issues there that are going to take a long, long time to fix. They've sacked their CEO recently, Thabang Moreau, for kind of, terrible financial mismanagement, perhaps worse than that. And Neil finishes a piece on his own website, which is worth checking out. If you've got any interest in South African cricket, always the best place to go. He writes, when England arrive in this country, they could be forgiven for feeling that they are visiting a smouldering battlefield, which is the state of cricket in South Africa now. But the positive news is we've got some cricket to watch in November, which was no guarantee. And it's another good test for England ahead of T20 World Cup.
Yeah, and it's part of the Cricket World Cup Super League, which we must mention. Yes,
of course.
But yeah, it should be really, because those games were great at the end of that test series early this year. That was a really exciting pair of white ball series. And obviously England have a few things to work on after this summer, and South Africa look kind of like a bit of a coming force again. So it should be really exciting. Just from a cricket point of view.
But absolutely. And I can't wait to watch more of Nokia up against England's, obviously, formidable batting lineup. That'll be great. Rabada's obviously in top form. Is there a chance De Villiers could even be persuaded to play in this one? Mm. It seems like a long shot, but you never know. And as you say before, Quinton de Kock's in fantastic form. So that should be great.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and also, you know, good news around the probability now that England will be playing in Pakistan as well. Similarly, an important kind of pioneering tour, really. And reflective of a more united world game probably than we've had in quite a while, and obviously the sense of helping one another out and propping up one another as we've seen for the last 6 months over here in England, and the same will almost certainly be applying in the early part of next year. It will be a week-long whistle-stop tour, is that right? In subject to the various checks and safety analyses and so on. Big Reg will be going out there for England and checking it all out.
Reggie D.
But important and positive and outward-looking moves by the ECB, which is being reflected in how, of course, other boards are responding to them as well. So, you know, it's good signs, I think.
And let's be honest, this is propping us up as well. As journalists, but also fans, it's going to be, without going into the dreary stuff too much, it's going to be a long winter and we all want some cricket to watch. So this is fantastic.
You'll get your
news.
TV sorted in time for it.
I really, really hope so. Otherwise, I'm going to have to come and sit in the office over the whole of winter.
In other English news, the structure of the county first class competition has been confirmed. So I'll see if I can get this all out. So it'll be three conferences of six who play each other twice, with two from each then going into three divisions, where all the teams who haven't yet played each other play each other once. The top of Division 1 are the county champions, and the top two in Division 1 contest the Bob Willis Trophy final. Jim, first of all, does that make sense? And second of all, do you like it?
I don't understand it, really. It might be because I'm not grasping it, but it seems overly complicated. And there's something that the Bob Willis, I don't know, they could have made more. I think it was because it was quite successful this year. They could have had it as its own sort of standalone thing, whereas now it's coming after the rest of it. It feels a bit like a tack on.
It feels more Charity Shield than FA Cup.
It feels a bit like a run out at the end of the season. But I have to be honest, it makes as much sense to me as the Test World Championship. So, yeah.
Jim's our resident humorist. You shouldn't ask him for serious nuance, yeah. Miserable questions like that.
I couldn't get up for that question at all.
He's not here for that. Okay, well, you know, he's not here for this.
Phil, what do you make of it?
Well, like, I'm not sure I am either. what do I think? I echo Jim's garbled point that he made up on the spot regarding the sense that it will be after the Lord Mayor's show somewhat, but then I don't think that's especially bad. It's a showpiece. It would be great for any county to win the double. It would be a joy to move into that Lord's final, having already taken the championship, and then to take that. Equally, it gives a county who's maybe overachieved somewhat another bite at the cherry. You know, so Somerset can fail twice rather than just once. The nature of that Lord's final was quite persuasive. It was certainly a sign of things to come, and so they want to have that. That celebration game at the end of the summer, so I can understand that. It will be slightly diluted. It will be slightly confusing to work out who's actually won what. But then it has the dual effect of sanctifying the championship. So the whole championship pennant, which has been since AD 12 or whatever, people have been scrapping it out for that. It returns that to the agenda, but it also maintains this nice showpiece thing at the end. So I can understand why they've done it. They've kind of taken a bob each way on it. Also, it's very important to point out that this is a one-off thing. Just on that, though, before Joe comes in, I've spoken to one or two CEOs and the three divisional six teams per division is pretty much rubber stamped from 2022 onwards. The issue is around the regionality or otherwise of it, whether it is divisions 1, 2, and 3 and a reflection of where teams have fallen in the last year or two, or whether it is a regional thing or whether it's a conference thing. And then if there's going to be maybe possibly semi-finals, or whether it would just be a final with the top two teams from those three divisions, that's still up for grabs. But the reduction in the number of games and the move to three tiers of six is looking very, very likely from 2022.
Yeah, well these are conferences for next year, so they're seeded based on sort of a confusing combination of positions.
Indeed.
From 2020 and 2020.
Indeed, which will probably be the favourite. And I don't know about you, Joe, but that's how I would want to go if we are going to see these three lots of six, because to regionalise it would mean that potentially, you know, Sussex and Durham don't play each other for 5 years, you know, and that just wouldn't really sit.
Anything with three tiers makes a lot of sense, really, in general.
Oh, nice. Political.
Yeah. There he is. That's more like it.
Roaring back.
Yeah, too complicated. I think I wouldn't have done it like this. I think keep it nice and simple. I wouldn't have departed. I could understand the need to potentially stick with regional this year, so I wouldn't have been against just doing what we had this year. Everyone plays each other twice, and then you have your grand final. And then the year after that, when hopefully the world has returned to something like normal, you have effectively, yeah, a Premier League, Championship, League One of the three sides based on how they've done over the last year. And I still would have the grand final at the end of that, and that would be the winner of the whole competition, not a kind of double winner, which I think is going to confuse fans, and no one's going to be quite sure what they want to win or what the big thing is. It just seemed it felt like one of those things where too many people have spoken at a meeting and you've got too many ideas. This is having had an editorial meeting about 2 hours ago. And actually everyone's just wanted their bit in there, and you've ended up with something more confused than it needed to be.
Yeah, I think I don't mind a few aspects of the structure. Like, I kind of like the race to Lords aspect of splitting into three divisions and having that top six be like a very concentrated thing. Two things that I worry about. Firstly, those divisions 2 and 3 are
dead games,
basically just playing four dead rubbers each team. So you got, yeah, which is a bit silly for me. And then also I would like that Lords final, they haven't confirmed the playing conditions for it yet, I would like it to be shared if the game is drawn, because if it's sort of a shop window game, I think that is the way you'll end up with more exciting finishes. Whereas if you have a team that, if they get out in front on a first innings and then can basically just, like, not dragging Essex here, they did what they needed to do to win the title this year, but if they can sort of get out in front and then just kind of hold the other team at arm's length, that doesn't make for particularly, or it might not make for particularly engrossing cricket. Whereas if you've got a situation where teams have to sort of set up a declaration on the last day and end up chasing, you know, 220 and 60 overs, that'll be a really good advert for first class cricket in England, I think, if this is going to be perhaps the game that's on Sky or that is made a big fuss out of. And I don't mind the two titles kind of thing. I think the county championship will end up being the one that people want to win, and yeah, the Bobolas trophy is kind of like an added extra that's like a sort of a nice end of season festival kind of thing. But I like that, I think.
Yeah, as ever, it is a devilishly tricky job to arrange the English season, and you have to try and placate the members. And members, albeit they don't make up an enormous percentage of people who are following cricket, but they are still significant, obviously. And overridingly, members want to see four-day cricket. More average fair-weather cricket fans, casual cricket fans, are not as fussed, but they want to see that. And there is a legit argument that you want, as in cricket lovers, we want to see especially young cricketers playing as much four-day cricket as possible. So I can understand the theory behind it, that 10 games may be insufficient in a season such as next year, when it's going to be a bit garbled anyway, that they can try and find a system to play a few more four-day games. I can understand the thinking there. But I don't think this will be the model from 2022 onwards. I'd be surprised if it plays out like that from next year.
Okay.
But we shall see.
Two other bits of news, I suppose, to tell you about. The Lanka Premier League draft has happened. That's a T20 league going to happen in Sri Lanka.
Yes.
Samet Patel and Liam Plunkett are the two England players who've been snapped up in that. So if you're fans of either of those two, that's your tournament.
Who's not?
And the Sheffield Shield is back. And it's unfortunately my job to tell you that Australia have found another one.
Yeah.
Phil, Cameron Green.
Cameron Green.
Tell us about him.
Well, I don't know an enormous amount. I think you probably should fill us in on this one. But I'm aware that he's essentially Bradman and Lily all rolled into one. He made 197 this week, and I saw some footage of it. And what struck me the most is just how gutted he was to be out three shy of a double 100.
He was absolutely
crestfallen. He was down on his haunches, dragged off the pitch, head down, tears flowing from his ducts. He was absolutely wrecked by it. And that to me just says 10,000, 12,000 test runs and probably 400 test wickets. And it's going to be agony to watch him. The other thing is that he doesn't really turn me on as a player, having seen him. He's tall. He's got touches of Crawley to him, but not quite as fluid. But he's just going to get runs, loads and loads and loads and loads.
Is he really
of them.
Young? How
he also
old is he?
21.
So okay. He's 21.
He averages 50.
Shall I do the stats, Phil?
Yeah, you take on the stats.
Not your area so much as
it is. A real brush off there, wasn't it?
You got my heckles up now. He did take 9 for 42 in a first class game. So he's played, a dozen first class games or something. He averages 50 something with a bat. We took 9 for 42 match figures.
Yeah, that's
just
good.
Just bowling 140 clicks, hitting the splice.
He's already annoying me.
And Cameron Green. Can you get a more Australian name?
Cameron Green. Yeah.
As has been said, he's 21 years old. Since the start of the 2019 Sheffield Shield season, he's got 500s, a high score of that, 197, about an average of about 70. Is now his overall first class record. I think it's averaging 55 with the bat and 22 with the ball, and that 22 with the ball is bowling above 140 kph according to reports.
He's batting four, isn't he, state cricket?
Yeah, and he's moved up the order quite quickly. Like, his first 100 was sort of a brilliant match save when they were sort of like 90 for six, I think, and then he hit 130, batting all day, partnering with the tail, and now he's kind of in that kind of prime position.
Interesting stuff, because Australia, they've not been blessed with all-rounders over the years. Shane Watson's probably about as close as they've come to a kind of genuine test all-rounder in my time of watching cricket, really. You go back to Keith Miller, but they haven't really that kind of 80s period where lots of teams had a great one. Australia didn't, so they'll have high hopes that they've finally discovered one. But who knows? I mean, there is the sense that he's a genuine all-rounder. That's what they're thinking of him as, rather than a batsman who bowls.
He didn't bowl in the game. He got the 190, and the 190 was in the second innings of the game. But then it could have been a knock. I don't know the details.
No, he hasn't been bowling as much recently. But then there's been a little bit of injury there, so I think he's sort of managing that for the moment. But the reports is that he is a proper bowler when he does bowl, as it were. So I guess he is going to be more of a batting all rounder. It seems like, but almost. I mean, you obviously Phil's already said talked him up to the hilt. But so I guess Jack Callis will be the mould, I guess, of the top
good
four batsmen who can also contribute with the ball more than handily.
He's got a decent shout of making that first test squad.
That's what the discussion is. He's the most likely to sort of break into that. Yeah.
Look forward to him ruining our Christmas next year.
Exactly. So speaking of great all-rounders, Ian Botham's wines. So during Sir Ian Botham's 40-year career in cricket, he has travelled the world both playing cricket and commentating. During this time, when he had a day or two off, he spent his spare time nurturing his other passion, which is wine and the art of creating it. So Ian has visited vineyards and wineries from around the world and has worked with renowned winemakers to hand-select parcels of wines that best represent his favourite regions and varietal to present his award-winning range. So Ian has created a range of wines that he is very proud and happy to serve at his own table to his family and friends. Sir Ian has personally selected an exclusive case of wine to share with Wisden readers and podcast listeners, which includes a signed photograph of the great man during the 81 Ashes. Head to bothamwines.com/product/Wisden-Botham-box to get yours today. That's bothamwines.com/product/Wisden-Botham-box to get yours today.
Flawless.
Thank you. Right then, this is what you've all been waiting for. Our season in the Sun 11.
Right, so what's this prompted by, Ben?
So it's inspired by Rahul Tewatia, who coming into the IPL with no real sort of pedigree behind him, has won Rajasthan Royals two games basically single-handedly from absolutely nowhere with the bat, and also took an absolutely brilliant catch last week, one of these sort of boundary rope jugglers. But what made it especially good was that like about 10 minutes before, he had given Robin Utapa an absolute bollocking for messing up a chance in the field. Yeah. when you've done that and then a really tough one comes your way, you've really got to take it, and he did it. He's just seems like an absolutely clutch player, but who knows.
And he's 30 odd years old, he's not even a journeyman, not really featured particularly.
Yeah, pretty much he's kind of one of the kind of matchup bowlers, so he sort of get in teams and often go through games bowling maybe one over but not really doing anything.
Okay.
Now he seems like a world beater this year.
So this
team then is an 11 of players who came from nowhere to shine for a time. It's a deliberately vague criteria so we can have sort of as cast on it as wide as possible.
It's a right old Motley Crue we've come out with.
We've done most of the arguing and scrapping off mic, so we won't have to bore you with that side of the debate, but we're going to run through the stories of our 11. So Joe, who's our first opener?
So our first opener, we're going with Dave Fulton. That's who you're expecting me to say.
Yeah.
Dave Fulton, yeah. So obviously Kent skipper for many years, but his career was kind of not going anywhere particularly fast, apart from possibly ending. So after making his first class debut in 1992, he scored 911 seasons. Then 2001 comes along and he scores 9 in the season. In the final year of his contract, career looks like it might be kind of disappearing quite quickly. And then that summer, he's very nearly picked for the Headingley Ashes test. Mark Butcher's broken curfew, possibly not for the first time. And Duncan Fletcher is sort of done with him. And at the last minute, Nasser Hussain convinces Fletcher to give Butcher one more go. And obviously, he plays one of the great test knocks by an England batsman. And Fulton never gets his chance with England. Then a couple of years later, he gets smashed in the eye, batting in the nets. Horrible, horrible injury. And he has, perhaps it's a little bit unfair to have him in this team because he did have other seasons where he got 1,000 plus runs. But it was this one season, 2001, where he scored 1,892 runs at 76, 900s in there. Fulton goes from almost losing his county contract to being on the verge of the England Test team.
And it's another one of these stories, what Joss Butler wrote on the top of his bat, famously.
F it.
Yeah. It's another one of those stories, really, that he'd become so wound up by county cricket, by the grind of county cricket, that he just reached the end, the end of hope, really, and just thought, right, well, sod it, see what happens. Opened up his stance, opened up his mind, and got a few runs initially, and it just sort of cascaded from there, really. And we ran something on him, didn't we, Joe, in the magazine a few months ago, and I did the interview, and I tapped him up for it. I've just found his WhatsApp message to me. He said, yeah, I thought you might come to me on this. It seems to resonate, my 2001, because it gives mediocre players hope that one day everything might click. This is from the man himself. And so he averaged 25 in his career until that year, up to the year 2000. And apparently it's the biggest differential in cricket history between a career average up to that point and a single average that a Sky statistician worked out.
Good stats.
Well, he's a worthy number one in our team then.
Yeah. Yeah. Just one other thing, just on his near call up, is that I think Rob Key made the confession on, I think, the Great Cricketer podcast recently that him and Graham Swan, while they were at the Under-19 World Cup, I think, had sort of also convinced him that he'd been called up, because Graham Swan is obviously England's impressionist in chief. So
one word for him, yeah.
So they and Rob Key had Fulton's phone number, and they were sharing a room and were bored at this Under-19 World Cup. So call up Fulton. Graham Swan does the impression of whoever, I guess it might have been Bumble at the time. And Fulton's absolutely so convinced that he had to call him back an hour later and say, actually, that was a wind up. You can
that's
you
really
can stand
cruel.
Down
that's horrible, there. Isn't it?
Really
yeah.
cruel.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
not like Graham.
Right. So, Phil, you've got our other opener.
Yes, I do. I'm not sure I fully agree with this selection, frankly.
You don't agree with the team as a whole, do you? It's a...
No. I'm comfortable with it. Certainly once we get to the bowlers, folks. You hang on for the bowlers. So Chris Broad has been considered to be our other opening bat. Chris Broad, big-bottomed left-hander, who was briefly electric for England in the 86-7 Ashes, as everybody knows, really. He made 300s. I didn't realise that he also made 100 against Australia in the bicentenary game in 1988. Did you know that, Joe?
Yeah, I did, right, actually. Fine. But right, only because I was looking at it recently.
Yeah, so he made 400 in six games against Australia, an average just a tick under 80. Made 600s in all from 25 test matches, and yet that was the extent of his England career. And he was the International Cricketer of the Year, so the precursor to the ICC's Cricketer of the Year. At the end of that Australian tour, he was... You would have thought at that point he would have just under 30. So he was, yeah, he just turned 30 at that point. So you would think, okay, England have found one here. Gooch is back from his Rebel tour. You actually now have an opening partnership that can really take England on. England being England, he had a couple of dud games against the West Indies the following summer, in 88, in fact. And after that, he was cast out. He was 32 in the summer of 1989. He'd made a lot of runs for Gloucester in the build-up and a lot of runs for Notts as well. And then he was one of those that took the filthy rand, in truth. He was on that Rebel tour of 89. And what was left of his Test career, which had been truncated by that point and was a bit bitty, he was in and out the side, as was everybody at the time, came to a sudden, abrupt end, really. And so he finishes with this peculiarly lopsided career. As I say, 600s from 25 games, four of which came in the Ashes, and yet was done and dusted and taking the filthy lucre.
Yeah, I think he fits for me because he...
Well, it was probably your pick, wasn't it?
Well, he was, yeah, but because of how dominant the Ashes is in discussing England players.
It's plausible to imagine that now, isn't it?
Yeah. To have a player, because player careers, their careers are built up to the Ashes, and they're like defined by that from then on as well. And sort of have a player who kind of came sort of from nowhere to then just dominate an Ash series, which was the last England won in Australia for what, 25 years, and then to basically fade from the scene thereafter. Yeah. Although, I mean, none of these players really fit perfectly, because you don't obviously get to professional cricket without being a good cricketer, and then you don't stick around for long enough to be a journeyman without actually having some good days here and there.
Well, there is one of the bowlers who kind of didn't really play professional cricket and ended up playing Test cricket.
Yes,
so, yeah, but we can come to that later. And one other thing on Broad, just briefly, is that he was deemed to be quite a tricky customer. And England's infamously bad tour of Pakistan in 87, the Shaka Rana Mike Gatting tour, Broad was on that tour. Broad was a prickly character and at one point refused to walk when he was given out. I mean, with good reason, when you look at it on YouTube. And that kind of, in inverted commas, petulance was reflected as well against the West Indies the following tour as well. He was vocally and obviously demonstrably pissed off with umpiring decisions. And when English cricket was collapsing morally at that time anyway... he was one of those that was deemed to be surplus to requirements, I think, because he was just considered a little bit too much like hard work.
Yeah. Maybe that inspired him to become an ICC match referee.
Old poacher turned gamekeeper thing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I thought we were going to get through without saying that.
No, sorry, no, you have to. All the cliches. Told you I don't like this idea.
So at number three, another contentious one, it's India's Gautam Gambhir, and I know what you're screaming at home.
Do you?
It's what we all screamed at you 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, it's the Gambhir. Obviously, you don't look at that Crick Info profile and think that here is an unfulfilled in any way cricketer. You know, played 50 odd tests, 4,000 runs, an average a tick under 42. Obviously, played a brilliant innings in a World Cup final. But when you look at that.
You're kind of talking about the team here.
But when you get to that Test career in isolation, so you got 900s, but seven of those came in a sort of 13-month stretch between October 2008 and November 2009. And at that point, he rose to number one in the world. You kind of think that India, alongside Sehwag, they have an absolute world beater here. I think the best of those probably was a following on in New Zealand to save India a game. And you kind of think, here's a player who can kind of do it everywhere against all kind of bowlers. He can, you know, destroy the spin in India. He can handle the quicks. And then it just didn't really happen. Then on, he got one more 100 and obviously was torn apart by Boycott when he was recalled in India in 2014.
It was, wasn't he?
Yeah, and eventually kind of just running himself out because he almost couldn't bear to be out there in a way.
Have you researched sufficiently to find out what his theory is himself, Gambier? Why that year he was just so much better than at any other point in his career?
No, but I think to be honest, I think that actually if you looked at quite a lot of cricketers' careers who we kind of see as having had in general good careers, you would be able to find sort
purple
of patches
patch.
Exactly that actually is what elevates them. Like we were discussing Ian Bell a while ago. Not that he at all fits into this 11, but that you are. He gets it even like 2009 when he's been a test cricketer for 4 years, and it's at that point that it kind of really clicks. And at that point, even then, it only clicks for what, 3 or 4 years or so. So he's making his way as a test cricketer for quite a lot longer than he's actually at his peak. But looking back, you think of Ian Bell, sort of brilliant test player for quite a long stretch of time. And I think that Gaston Gambier just sort of concentrates that a little bit more, as it were. And you know, so players just, I think it's mostly just form, really, is that they just come and go, but Gambier's was especially, and just to be number one batsman in the world is what really tipped him for me, because to get up to that,
that is an anomaly.
Okay, you make a good case. You countered your initial case with a very strong case,
but it's probably an apposite time to say, anyone listening in who does have an opinion otherwise for our number three, then please do shout across all the horrible social media disgrace platforms.
Yes, and Jim, you've got our number four, I think.
This is a good one. David Ward.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, one of my faves, actually. Nasher.
I wonder why.
A phenomenal bloke. Really popular around these parts at Surrey. He could often be seen strolling around the boundary, chatting to the members, and a very popular figure. Croydon-born carpenter and joiner. Didn't play his first-class match until he was 24. Quite old.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And he played a one-day game really late, didn't he, when he was...
Oh, God, yeah. There's some images.
When he was a teacher.
Yes.
I think he was a Whitgift teacher, maybe, and they had an injury...
Sorry.
So, didn't know he'd actually made some notes.
Yeah, absolutely. So, 2000... So, Joe, I came across your article, actually, about the year of the bat in 1990, and that's the year that Ward scored over 2,000 first-class runs, including 7 tons at 76 point something. And then he retired in 1994 on 294 not out. Alex Stewart declared with him 6 short.
Brutal gaffer.
300. And that was his last first class knock. Anyway, so then he went on to become...
That was his last first class innings, 294 not out.
Alex Stewart retired him.
Yeah. What a way to go out, that is.
So at the end of Joe's piece, Joe can tell you, because he obviously spoke to him for this, but he says, the first game of the following season, I asked Stewie, Alex Stewart, what number I was batting, and he said number 6. I said, I've just scored 2,000 runs last year. That was last year, he replied. Normal service resumed.
Oh, the gaffer.
Yeah.
So many prisoners.
You're right. He did have a glorious comeback. So he was coaching at Whitgift. So I don't know if he's still... I think he might still be there. But
He was when I spoke to him, just a few months ago.
Burns, Roy and Sibley obviously all came through that route. And he was coaching there in 2002, where I don't know what happened, but Surrey were woefully short of players. And he was convinced to play a Sunday league game against Northants at Whitgift. Maybe he was doing detention or something on a sort of Sunday morning. Age 41, opened the batting and smashed 78 in 52 balls.
Oh, marvellous. You and imagine then, that when a few of your kids are there.
Sir!
Yeah.
Yeah, so, a phenomenal bloke. Very popular figure. And, a cult favourite.
Moving swiftly on to number five, which is my personal favourite in this 11, Paul Valtatti.
I think I didn't know who this person was.
Yeah, it's a great name for a start. So he did play India under-19s back in the early 2000s, but then when the IPL came along, he didn't really get a gig at first. I think he played his first game in 2009. Again, didn't really do much. And then all of a sudden, in the 2011 IPL, basically unknown, opening the batting, smashes 120 off 63 balls against Ravi Ashwin, Morkel and Tim Southee to single-handedly win Punjab a game. Then next game, still opening, smashed 75 off 47. And then that was basically it. He got one more 50 that season, none in 2012, and was dropped in 2013. Hasn't played IPL since. He's since playing like a sort of a lower level T20 competition, even though he's 36, is somehow a development player. So I'm not quite sure how that works. But just a kind of a shooting star of player. And sort of a... shows how the IPL, as well as being a vehicle for discovering players, gives these kinds of players, like Tuatia, sort of a reason to kind of to keep going back, because you might have this chance to kind of get superstardom for a day, I suppose.
So
I
thought, and it can elevate them so quickly, can't it? All it takes is one knock, whereas compare it to, say, the Blast here. you can have a good season and get a good contract, and that's your kind of career set for the next couple of years. But in the IPL, you can basically hit 30 off 10 balls and suddenly be a superstar. and there's still no other league like that. It doesn't exist in the same way in Big Bash. And also, there's just so much cricketing talent in India bubbling away that doesn't necessarily get a chance. And then you get these names suddenly emerge, and some become superstars and some disappear a couple of games later.
Mm. Yeah, that's why he's number five in the engine room. He can come and sort of capitalise on the platform laid by Fulton, Ward and Co. Yeah.
Lovely.
Number six, it's the Rahul Tuatia 11. So we've got to have our leg spinning all rounder.
Is he captain?
Number six. Yeah, why not? I was reluctant to include
this
current players
stuff
in this. This is great. I was reluctant to include current players in this because who knows, he could yet go on to become a proper world beater.
Sure,
but just on the theme, he's there. And we'll come back to the keeper later and that will be explained why. But Phil, you've got our first quick.
Right. In at seven?
Well, why not? I mean, well...
Seven's a keeper, so it's...
Sorry, okay. Yeah. All right, so 8, 9, 10, 11, just interchangeable, that's fine.
Yeah, and some of the others, we've got a proper bunnies as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Okay, so Frank Tyson, really, the typhoon himself. He was described by both Benno and Bradman as the quickest bowler they'd ever seen up to that point. And that point was 1954-5. That Ashes tour that England won, having been demolished 4 years beforehand. He took, in all, 76 test match wickets from 17 games at an average of 18 and a bit. The majority, well, not the majority, but a good chunk of those were taken in that one series. He took 10 for at Sydney. Well, he took one for 160 to begin with in the first test match. And then he shortened his run-up and took 10 for at Sydney and then took 9 for at Melbourne to ace those two games and essentially clinch the series for England. The 7 for 27 that he took at Melbourne in the second innings is considered to be perhaps the most ferocious, appallingly terrifying Ashes spell, certainly this side of Mitchell Johnson. And he was big, tall, strapping, but so much of his pace was generated by this kind of sort of unusually elongated delivery stride. And of course, back in the old days, you could drag your back foot because of the no ball rule and so on. And while he got a lot of his pace and a lot of his propulsion from that delivery stride, it was also asking for trouble from an injury perspective. And so when he got home from that Ashes tour, those hard Australian pitches had taken their toll on his body and his frame, and as a test cricketer, there wasn't anything left for him after that. He staggered along playing for North Ants. He had a decent county career, but he wasn't renowned. He wasn't at a fashionable club. He didn't win championships. He was at North Ants and so on. Injuries took their toll and he was done with the professional game by the age of 30. He was an interesting character. He was a sort of Shakespeare-quoting, Wordsworth-quoting, wordsmith, a university man. So a break from the archetype of the sort of strapping, wordless, farmhand, fast bowler of the time. And he emigrated to Australia soon after, became a head teacher out in Melbourne as well, and finally coached Victoria and became a well-respected writer and commentator on the game. But... He's one of these fleeting quicks. Rare we get through a week without talking about Simon Jones, but that's the man that you think of. And Test cricket, and indeed cricket generally, is littered with these stories of quicks who redefined what it was and burnt very bright and flickered and then was extinguished all too early. And Tyson was probably... The most natural archetype of that, really.
There was also that kind of fairy tale elements to the Tyson story, where that in that Sydney test when he took 10 wickets, he got hit on the back of a head by a Ray Lindwall bouncer.
Yeah.
Was knocked to the floor, and David Frith wrote about this for us a few years ago. The crowd kind of thought he was dead, just lying there unmoving for a bit, and then he kind of rises like Lazarus and just destroys Australia's batting. Taking
well, like the Undertaker.
Or him.
Yeah, that's not, and that's the thing for me with Frank Tyson is that like growing up as sort of like a cricket fan, but not one who was sort of scouring the record books, he was someone that you kind of, he would be mentioned along with England, other England fast bowlers. So you'd kind of, if you, before you check it, you kind of assume from how people talk about him, that he was sort of like a 60, 70 test player who took, you know, 200 wickets and was one of the true greats, when actually he managed to build sort of like a legacy on the back of this one
series. Two test matches, really. Yeah. Melbourne-Sydney game, but it's because it's that game, isn't it? It's because it's that rivalry that what you do there is amplified and elevated. I remember we did our, years and years ago, we did our all-time Ashes cult heroes, and mine was the Typhoon, because it's just such a good hipster's choice. It just works so perfectly.
And he quotes Wordsworth, which you probably quite like.
Yeah, you know, he's sort of pretentious and self-regarding, and also can play a bit of cricket, you know, so what's not to love about that?
Jay, you've got our next seamer, who's not quite Frank Tyson, I think.
He's not Frank Tyson. I was a bit surprised that he made the cut, but I'm delighted that he did, especially now I've done a bit more research.
I haven't even read our 11, so I don't know who this is.
Okay, so this is
news to us.
This is Dr. Julian Barton de Courcy Thompson.
Oh, Jules.
A Cape Town-born former Kent fast bowler from the 90s who juggled his cricket career with a career in medicine. So he played a bit of second team cricket early 90s, but was always having to primarily be a doctor. Made his debut in 94, then in the summer of 95, playing against the touring West Indians, only his third first class game, he dismisses Brian Lara for a duck in each innings, the only bowler ever to do that in a first class game.
What?
And then doesn't really play for the next, that's not his summer in the sun, by the way, so he doesn't even play for the next few years, just plays a couple of games here and there where his shifts allow at the hospital. Then in 1999 he decides he's going to give cricket a proper go, plays a full season with Kent, takes 64 wickets at 19. He's named Kent's Player of the Year, signs a new contract, ready to commit to cricket, going to leave the doctor stuff behind, and then gets a knee injury, never plays another game of professional cricket, and goes back to being a doctor.
Wow. So he had
his season in the sun with Lara double as the precursor, and then never seen again in professional cricket. He was named an honorary GP at Kent County Cricket Club.
Oh, that's nice. Do all clubs have an honorary GP?
I don't think so.
Okay, just
this is definitely one of your back in the day interviews, Joe, isn't it?
I should do that. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously quite a lot of them revolve around Kent, but that's okay.
It's all right. You know, if you've got a dicky knee, stick or something, you can double up, get yourself checked out.
Maybe you can pitch a Skybox show.
That's
a good doctor.
That's a brilliant story.
So that is Dr. Julian Barton de Courcy Thompson.
Brilliant.
De Courcy is strong.
Yeah, and Jim, you've got our final quick.
Who else is a de Courcy in cricket stats trivia?
Is it West Indian fast bowler?
No, almost half right.
What, one of the W's?
Yeah,
Everton. Oh.
Weeks. Well done, Ben.
Good knowledge.
Cough. The tension in the room. Right, let's crack on.
Yeah, Jim, you've got our next quick.
Jeff Allott.
Yes.
he said certainly.
He's in.
Jeff Allott.
Yeah, so he's in for his 99 World Cup where he took 20 wickets, not a lot. He 4 for 37 against Australia, 4 for 64 against Pakistan, 4 for 35 against South Africa. I think you already mentioned Big Bums once, but he's, you know, sizable behind Mark Elam-esque, but left-hander.
People don't talk about the decline of the big bottom fast bowler enough, do they really?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah, big bottom, bell bottom, 99 Kiwi. Lovely stuff. I looked at some YouTube footage before. I did do my research. He had, and someone else mentioned this online, he was one of the most famous shoe cutters, fast bowler, and he had a little bit of sock sticking out of his but you mentioned rabbits earlier, so Jeff Allott in another he's got the longest test duck. So he batted for 101 minutes, 77 balls against South Africa at Auckland in 1999 before Jack Callis got him out. Of course he did. And I quite like this little detail. As he was walking off after the longest duck in Test history, he raised his bat to all corners of the ground.
Lovely.
That is lovely, yeah. And I think that was one of those torturous partnerships for the last wicket where sort of the batsman was getting like a single off the fourth ball of every over. Yeah. And it was very much just that. It was basically like a run and over partnership that was a...
But he's faced a lot of balls there, 77 balls.
Yeah, but so it went on for absolutely ages, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So Jimmy's 55 at Headingley against Sri Lanka, is number two.
Well, there you go.
Good stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess World Cups are the other real chance in this thing. He's the only one we've got for their World Cup exploits, but you do get those players, don't you, who kind of just...
Well, that was it. I think it was my nomination. He was an honest toiler who had this one World Cup summer where I think at the time he was the leading wicket taker ever in a World Cup. And it was early season English conditions suited him perfectly. And then for the rest of the career, he was fine. He was a decent seamer, but there was just a kind of 6 week period where
he hooped it around.
The best seamer in the country.
Some great wickets, lots of bowls and LBWs.
Top order wickets, good batsman.
Yeah. Warne pipped him actually. Warne got one more wicket in one more game in that 99 World Cup.
So Phil, you've got, obviously we've got Tuati can roll his arm over for some leggies, but he's mostly there to smash 30 runs off and over, having really struggled up until that point. Yeah. So you've got our spinner.
Yeah, so Jack Iverson, a Victorian, Australian mystery spinner. If people really want to know about him, go and read Gideon Hayes' astonishing biography of Iverson. It's a real masterpiece. Jack Iverson was an off-break bowler who may have been a leg break bowler, who may have been an off-break bowler, who may have been a leg break bowler. He redefined what wrist and finger spin was. He predated the carom ball. He was in the army in the late 40s, and he spent many, many weeks with a tennis ball on his own, practicing how to spin a ball off his middle finger. And the middle finger in the end became so strong, and he had these incredible strong fingers. He was a big man, a big, cumbersome, lugubrious kind of bloke. And he could spin a tennis ball initially and then a cricket ball off that middle finger, so it would go in either direction with no change in the action. He played sub-district cricket in Melbourne throughout his 20s. He only started playing district cricket in Melbourne when he was 31. And from then on, he started to make a name for himself because he was able to deliver these balls with, as I say, no discernible change in his approach, spinning it off that finger, and it was impossible to read. For 2 years, maybe even three, he was broadly unstoppable in district grade cricket in Australia, to the extent that he was promoted to play for Victoria. He had one or two seasons for Victoria and averaged next to nothing for his wickets. England were due. This was the late 40s, turn of the decade. England were due in 1950-51. Len Hutton was the skipper at that time. England didn't have a great side at that point. But they turned up in Australia, and Iverson had almost by accident moved to the front of the queue. He played all of those test matches against England. He played five test matches, of which that was the entirety of his test career. He took 21 wickets at 17, I think. Just let me check that. 15, sorry. Cheers, Joe. 21 wickets at 15. England were clueless. Hutton was asking everyone in Australian cricket what's going on, and nobody had the answer because he was an unknown, because he just emerged out of nowhere. So he was asking great old players. He asked Bradman. He asked Morris. He asked players who just retired, players who could help him through, and no one had any answers. He was unstoppable for the first half of that series. Hutton, in the end, being the genius that he was, figured out that he had to play him as an off-break bowler. And echoes of Murali. And now the carom ball may have been more Mendes latterly in our time, but that's how people ended up playing Murali. You play him as an off-break bowler, and the one that goes the other way, well, so be it. Hopefully we're going to miss it. Hutton, by the end of the series, had figured this out. But for the start of the series, he was as flummoxed as anybody else. In the fourth test match, Iverson did a McGrath, and he stood on the ball, and he twisted his ankle quite badly. He staggered through that test match, played the final test match and took three or four. But the damage had been done earlier on in that series. he was by this point 35 years old anyway. And that final test match, which he limped through with a busted ankle, was his final appearance for Australia in international cricket. So he retired having played just the one series. It's an astonishing story, really. And he vanished just as quickly as he'd emerged, really. It didn't help that he was considered to be one of the worst fielders in the history of professional cricket. So bad that he didn't even bend down to get the ball. He just used to boot it to the nearest fielder. He was as bad with the bat as he was in the field, and as reluctant to get involved in that kind of caper. He was simply a genius with his middle finger. And that middle finger dominated an Ashes series against Hutton and the like.
I like the, if you go to his Crick Info profile, rather than a picture of his face, which every other profile has, you've actually just got a picture of his middle finger.
Yeah.
And finally, the bit you've all been waiting for, the keeper. Joe, is this your favourite player, would you say? Tony Frost?
Whatever. Yeah. No? Do I need to for the benefit of the...
No, not at all, no.
It's Julian De Courcy, surely.
He's one of those that always seems to come up on this podcast and we always sort of go to you for it. So it seems like you're his biggest fan.
No, I'm not. No, but he's got a proper county cricket story, which I guess is why it always crops up. So he was Warwickshire's keeper for many years, did a very solid job. Fine batsman, but not especially not a keeper, not a batsman keeper. He retired at the end of the 2006 season. First class average 28, so fine, good career. He decides rather than kind of going off, leaving cricket altogether, he wants to be a groundsman at Edgbaston, and is very happy with his life there, enjoying the tranquility, sitting on his mower, still being part of the club, but not playing anymore. But then the winter of 2007, when Tim Ambrose gets called up for England, Ashley Giles, who's just become Warwickshire's coach, gives him a tap on the back and says, we need a keeper for the season. Just filling in here and there, Frost says, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Why not? I'll come back again. And then what follows is this incredible season where Frost is keeping wicket initially, but when Ambrose comes back into the side, Frost continues as a specialist batsman because he's just scoring run after run after run in county cricket. So he finishes a season by scoring an unbeaten double hundred in the penultimate match against Essex, his first of his career, and then goes past 1,000 runs in the final game of the season. Finishes the year with 1,003 runs at 84, edging out Amla, Trott and Ramprakash to finish top of the averages in the whole country, having started his year sitting on a mower looking after the lawn at Edgbaston. And he played one more year, did all right, and then thought, no, that's it, I'll go back to being a groundsman, then joined the ground staff again for a couple of years, and now he's batting coach at Warwickshire. Dom Sibley praised Frost as one of the main reasons behind his resurgence. So I think he's been at Warwickshire for 27 years now, still doing his thing.
I hope he's still got a mower. He just coaches while on his mower.
I'd be really surprised if he doesn't. He talked about his season with kind of a lot of enjoyment, but it was really the mower.
It was the mower that did it for him.
That got him going. So he's your perfect season in the sun, and it took him as much by surprise as did everyone else, I think.
Mm-hmm. And the reason we've added him is not only because he's one of the only ones that actually really fits into this 11, but also because you've interviewed him for the latest Wisden Cricket Monthly, which is out this week.
Seamless.
I think we've got enough of flavour of Tony Frost now. But what are the other highlights of that issue?
Well, as people listen to last week's show will remember, we've got the 12 best young batsmen in England profiled based around an exclusive interview with Zach Crawley. So that is the lead feature. That's the cover story. But a couple of things I'll pick out, and then Phil, you can pick out a couple of things if you can remember.
Wow.
What? Okay. That's taken you by surprise.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, I'll play for time. My favourite piece in the whole magazine is John Houghton's piece on Geoffrey Boycott at 80. It's a challenging subject to cover, obviously, hugely divisive. And John does it beautifully, talking about some of the darker elements of his character, but also recognising some of the incredible achievements he's made in his career. Speaking to people like Dan Norcross, who sat alongside him in the commentary box, the Test Match Special, who talks about how intimidating it was, but how he grew to become quite fond of him over the years, albeit
always a kind of tricky personality in some ways. So I would absolutely recommend reading that piece from John. That is a brilliant piece of work.
It's a masterpiece, that.
It is, yeah. I mean, John, everything he writes is beautiful, but that is particularly good. And rattled off in about a day as well, because he'd spoken to Mike Brearley for something else and was like, well, just give me a day, and then this turns up, which is beautiful for an editor. And then Michael Holding interview by John Stern, our editor at large, which is talking to Holding Reeling about this unexpected somewhere where he's kind of broken out from the confines of the game, had an opportunity to speak in a way that hasn't really presented itself before, and been able to articulate some of the things that have concerned him hugely, obviously related to the Black Lives Matter debate this summer. He's always an interesting man to listen to, and none more so than this summer, where there's been much more than cricket to talk about.
Mm, yeah, and Phil, your favourite was Shields, wasn't it?
Shield Berry's piece on the season, unlike any other. This magazine's got some really good writing in it, some real virtuoso wordsmithery, and Shields' piece slips right in there. It's really elegiac and stylish and slightly melancholy, but driven by a deep, enduring love for the thing, which Shield does better than anybody, I would say. So that's glorious. Just one other thing. Remember the Compton Cricket Club, the LA Cricket Club?
Yes.
The Los Angeles Cricket Club from a few years back. Unlikely story, founded in downtown LA to combat the effects of poverty and homelessness in the area at the time. The story went global. Nick Compton turned up, didn't he? Of course he did, yeah. Anyway, Ben Falk, who's first time he's actually contributed to us, I think, but he's an author's CC stalwart, very fine writer. He's returned to the Compton CC story to find out where the key protagonists ended up and what's happened to them since. That's another top piece of work, really. Mark Wood on Howie Bowls Quick as well. It's a nice feature as well.
Zahir Abbas.
All the fun of the fair. Oh, and Zahir Abbas, yeah. Zahir Abbas gives us his story of his life as well, which is a cracker. Yeah, it's all the fun of the fair, as ever.
My favourite piece is a very important piece by Izzy Westbury on diversity in cricket media, which obviously we can talk about, you know, the lack of representation at the top level of the game, but almost that matters less if the people telling the stories aren't going to understand them enough to be able to put them into words and voice properly. So that's
indeed. She's done that expertly. She's also written her first column for us. She's signed up as a regular columnist now for us. A brilliant, fearless piece as ever. A probing piece, which is very much her style, on the kind of the underbelly of the IPL out in the UAE, and the have-nots bubbling under the surface of the haves and the have-plenties. So it's a brilliant piece by her. She joins the stable along with Andrew Miller and Adam Collins and Joey Harmon and Ben Gardner and Jim Wallace and all the rest of them.
Yeah, well, that magazine is, as I say, it's out now. Head to wisdom.com to pick that one up.
Do it.
And that's the end of the show. Yaz should almost certainly be back next week, as long as he's not got himself trapped under any falling rocks or anything like that. Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed it, please tell your friends. And if you've really enjoyed it, maybe leave us a nice, even a 5-star review on the podcast app.
4 will do.
Cheers.
3.